This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Port Orange Elementary School has been named one of the healthiest schools in America. So what does that designation mean? For Port Orange, it meant changes to the menu in the school cafeteria, refocusing PE lessons, and building physical activity into other classes too. From the Education Desk this week, a look at designing a healthier school day. Tennille Wallace is the principal at Port Orange Elementary School. Tennille, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I'm also joined by Julie Curtin. She is the PE teacher at Port Orange Elementary. Julie, thank you as well.
Thank you very much.
So the school has been named one of America's healthiest schools. It's the award or the recognition comes from the Alliance for a Healthier Generation. Tennille, what does this mean?
I think this is a wonderful reflection of our responsibility as a school to be responsive to our community, a community-responsive organization. Mm-hmm. It's so much more than teaching students to read and, you know, manipulate math, but it goes to our mission of inspiring students to learn, grow, and strive for excellence every day. And this is just part of that.
Is this something that you've been working towards for some time?
Julie can answer that.
I just became a PE teacher last school year. I was a classroom teacher for 19 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I love it. And actually, I just read about it in the News Journal last year when I was when I first got the job, mm-hmm. that another school had gotten that award. And so I called that school and said, hey, can you tell me more about that? What did you have to do? And so we collaborated together. And then I got on the website and started filling out the paperwork and making sure everybody was doing all these things and checking everything off. And it's a lot of work, but it paid off. We've had so many great changes at our school.
So does the driving force for this, the kind of healthy school initiative, does that come from the PE department?
It doesn't have to. I try to make it that way because, you know, we're physically active and they see that, and I bring all the nutrition stuff in. And I mean, other schools may not do it that way, but I think it's the best way to do it. Cause, mm-hmm. And the kids get so excited. They love coming to PE now. They tell me all the great foods they're eating, all the great things they're doing after school. So it's a really great thing. I love it.
So the food and the healthy eating, that is something that you've built into the curriculum?
Yes. With our Schoolway Cafe, they used to like sell chips and ice cream. We don't do that anymore. They stopped all that. They only have ice cream on Thursdays that can be bought. They brought in more fresh fruit instead of like the canned fruits and things like that. More salads, more pronounced. They're out there for the kids to really get a good look at those. And just the way they display their things. So it's an all-school, whole-family thing that we do.
Tennille, was it a struggle for the kids to let go of some of those elements on the school menu? Like, was there a bit of an uproar when you took the chips away?
Not at all. Not at all. I think it was a great change. As we said, we just changed the visual culture in the cafeteria to be one of healthy eating, healthy lifestyle, lots of movement. And just focused on the positive aspects of it. And it really has been a great change and quite easy to get the kids to, you know, adapt.
And how much flexibility do you have designing like a healthier menu? Because are you kind of tied to what the county says you can do, or do you have a lot of leeway?
It's definitely been a work of collaboration, you know, conversations back and forth of things we were hoping to achieve. And, you know, we made some strides this year, but of course we were brainstorming our list on the way of things we want to increase and do next year. With the award, we were given a bronze status. Mm-hmm. So there's also a silver and a gold. So, you know, our sights are on gold for next year. So we were looking to see what criteria we needed to change and improve to get to gold next year.
I guess PE is one component of it, and there's also the nutrition aspect that Julie was talking about, but is it something that sort of filters into other classes as well, other subjects?
Well, the healthy lifestyle really is across the board. It's in the classrooms, it's in the community, it's with the families. The award focuses on six different areas: school health, health education, physical education, nutrition services, health promotion for staff, which was a big part of what we had accomplished, and then the family and community involvement. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, we really see ourselves as supporting the whole community and the whole child. And so, you know, we know that physical activity improves, you know, brain function and learning for students. We know that we have to take care of ourselves and take care of each other. The social emotional learning and, you know, all of that ties together for the betterment of our community and our families.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to Tennille Wallace and Julie Curtin. at Port Orange, with Port Orange Elementary School, rather, about their award, one of America's healthiest schools. Tennille, did you have to kind of redesign or rethink some of the way the kind of day played out, like as far as where you would have PE and how those things kind of fit together? Because if you're talking about, you know, brain function and making sure the kids are alert when they're sitting down in their classrooms, do you then have to think about where you do PE, like what sort of times you give them that break?
Absolutely. You have to be flexible and creative. We want them to have as much movement as we can during the day, but we balance that with requirements in the classroom as well. So being creative of doing things before school, fitting times in after during the day, and then also after school to get as much movement and creative expression, you know, as we can in those opportunities.
Julie Curtin, what is it like being a PE teacher now compared to when you were a student? Has that job changed a lot?
It has changed a lot. I remember my PE coaches when I was in school, and you had to do things you didn't want to do all the time, like especially with girls. You know, I don't want to go out and do that.
Run laps,
yeah,
for
run
example.
Laps, walk the court. But now it's like it's more fun. We have a lot more things we can do now. We could incorporate technology. I've tried to incorporate reading and math into that. I allow them to choose a couple different items to do at one time instead of having to all play one sport, and they really, really love that. And so I try to embrace them, want them to want to come, want to have fun. The sweatier, the better. So, they like it. And then I also give some of the classroom teachers, we have brain breaks. So they have little videos that they get that they can put on just for a movement throughout the day. So that adds to it. That's like 10 minutes a day. But yeah, so we always try to get as much activity as we can in.
Mm-hmm. There are so many apps these days that you can use to track and measure the kind of activities you're doing. Is that something that elementary school kids embrace?
They love that, yes. I even have students, I'll have my Apple Watch, and they'll want to wear it. They please let me put it on, and they start running around to see how fast their heart rate's going. Mm-hmm. I mean, just things like that. It's just really a lot of fun things they do. And with looking at the steps and watching their steps and monitoring those things, they really enjoy doing it. And the technology, like I said, is amazing. So there's so many things we can do.
Tennille Wallace, one of the big debates there's been in Florida has been recess and how to sort of build that into the day and whether kids are getting enough activity. How did Port Orange tackle that issue?
I think recess and movement is critical. It doesn't always have to be outside. Like she said, the brain breaks in the classroom are a great way to get 5 or 10 minutes in different places. Again, being creative, we have, you know, talked with our special area teachers about ways to incorporate movement in what they're doing. So it's not always part of the reading curriculum or math curriculum, but it can be. There's lots of ways to incorporate movement and physical activity within the classroom too. So it's just being creative, thinking outside of the box, innovating, you know, where you can fit in, because it's critical for kids to learn to be able to move and improves that brain function. So it's critical to what we do.
I'm reading here, Julie Curtin, some of the things that Port Orange Elementary put in place to win this award. One of them is a mile club and a girls on the run club, and a Go Take a Hike fundraiser, which sounds interesting. But tell me about the running club. Is that like a real change of approach as far as getting kids involved in those kind of activities?
Yes, it's an after-school activity. It's free. There are certain grade levels on certain days of the week, and they collect miles or collect laps as they go along. And every mile or so, they get a little foot or thing, a little necklace thing to add to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a challenge for them, and they love that. That's like an hour after school. Last year was 2 days a week, mm-hmm. or 1 day a week. And then the Girls on the Run, that's a whole separate program. And it was for girls. It was also like an empowering thing for girls. And that was a really great program we had as well. So and then the Go Take a Hike, that is it's a fundraiser they have. He's based in Orlando. And they come to the school. They do the whole thing, set everything up. And then, you know, it's a fundraiser. So you raise money. And then you go and they walk laps. And then, yeah, we raised over $12,000 with that. So it was a really great thing, too.
And then the nutrition classes, that is connection with the University of Florida, right?
Yes.
How does that work?
Contact them. They come out and they set up times with the different grade levels. It's K-5, so everyone gets it. And then they set up and it's a 6-week program. So they come once a week for 6 weeks for each class. And it covers the My Plate and it covers all the healthy eating and the germs and all the different food groups.
What are some of the challenges, though, when you're talking about food and like diets, because there are a lot of diets out there, and I imagine some kids might be a little bit sensitive to being overly aware of what they're eating and body image and stuff. So you have to be a bit careful about the way you teach some of these components.
Oh, yes. I mean, The University of Florida has an amazing program. So they come out and they just talk about ways to eat healthy. You know, there's like good foods and there's sometimes foods and there's, you know, things like that. They never say how many calories you're supposed to have a day.
Right.
They just want you to be healthy and offer and say, you know, fruits and vegetables and choose more of that. And so they do it in the most amazing way.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask, too, about your change from being a classroom teacher to a PE teacher. What motivated you to switch gears there?
I needed a change. 19 years in the classroom. I love teaching. I love all my kids. I always have. But I needed something different. And I wanted to become a guidance counselor. That was my goal, was for that. Then our PE teacher ended up leaving. And so I asked my principal, if I take the test, can I do this instead? And I passed the test. And I used to be anorexic. And so being able to help kids, it's my goal was to be able to do something like that. And now I'm able to do it every day. And it's just, I don't talk about, you know, weight or this, just being healthy, exercising each day. And I don't want anyone to ever have to go through what I went through. So I try to balance it out. That's why it's very important not to talk about sensitive things like that with weight.
Do you mind if I ask, when were you able to address that issue, anorexia? Like when were you able to sort of make the steps and get the help you needed?
It was high school. I was bullied. I was picked on. I was teased, being overweight, all these things. I got braces, which didn't help much. But then people started saying, oh, it looks like you're losing weight. I was starting to get more attention. I don't even know what I weighed. I was way overweight. I went down to 48 pounds, and I was 16 years old. And they said I wasn't going to live any longer. I'm done. That's it. And so my parents put me in the hospital. I was in there for almost a year, tube fed through my nose, started getting counseling. My parents had to buy me a car when I weighed 100 pounds. But seeing what happened, and I started talking to the high schools when I couldn't come back to school. Our health teacher actually called me and said, hey, can you come in and talk in my health class about what you went through? And I was helping all these kids, like, oh, thank you for telling me that. Thank you. My sister, I think she has this. And it was just like, oh, my gosh, this is it. And it's taken all this time. But I've always pushed it with my kids in my classroom anyway, too. We never pick on anybody. That was a big no-no with me. So I've always been using it, but now I just can talk about it a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to get with every kid. I always, you know, hi, good morning, I love you, you know, every kid, every day. So they had every kid every day. And they know I'm there for them. They come and tell me what they've been doing. And they're excited about PE. It's just so great. It's just so great.
And you've got your eyes set on a further recognition for the stuff you're doing at the school down the track.
Yes, of course. I like our school getting recognition. We deserve it.
Tennille, talk a little bit about the community, because it's not a huge student population. You have like some 400 students.
We're right at 400 students. Yep, K to 5.
So how involved are the parents? How invested are they in this process of becoming a healthy school and a healthier school in the future?
I think like every school, we have a lot of very invested parents, and we have all the parents are doing the very best they can to support their kids. You know, they send us their very best every single day. And our commitment, one of our five core values is a supportive learning environment. And it's critical for us to do everything we can for our families every day. And if we can help them when they're young to learn how to eat healthy and help the families while they're there, then we're giving back to the community by doing that. That's really important.
Is there much of an issue with some families who maybe have a bit of trouble putting food on the plate to their kids at Port Orange Elementary?
Absolutely. We do struggle with that. Our county provides free breakfast for all students. We have a free and reduced lunch program. And then we also offer free dinner to our extended day students. So we're able to service three meals a day for our kids that are there.
And the challenge isn't just getting enough to eat, it's also getting enough of the right kinds of things to eat, right?
Absolutely. It's all a balance, you know, like we talked about. We've had similar but different stories, but it's definitely a balance of making sure we're making good choices, whether it's eating or exercise or things like that. Good choices is important.
Do you have any other teachers at your school who are looking at what Julie's doing and saying, hey, I want to be a PE teacher too?
Well, with 400 students, I don't have too many PE openings, but we're all, our community is very supportive. Our teachers are supportive. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that makes our school unique is we are very family oriented and we, you know, we care about each other and love each other. And I think that's, you know, what's helping us move along in this journey.
And have other schools reached out to you and said, what are you doing and can we steal some of your ideas?
I'm sure we will be collaborating with many of them moving forward, yeah.
Well, Tennille Wallace is the principal of Port Orange Elementary School. Tennille, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Also joined by Julie Kirsten, PE teacher. Julie, thanks as well.
Oh, thank you very much.
And Port Orange was just named one of America's healthiest schools. Still to come on Intersection, they say a picture is worth a thousand words. Well, Orlando Sentinel photographer Red Huber has taken thousands of photographs. He spent a career telling stories from behind the camera.
Whether it's a sad story or a happy story, I want to show that emotion, that human element.
Huber's retiring, but he's not hanging up his cameras. A conversation with Red Huber when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Orlando Sentinel photographer Red Huber has been taking photographs for the paper for 46 years. Now he's hanging up his cameras and retiring from the Sentinel. He joins us now for a look back at a career in photography. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Matthew, for having me. I'll never hang up my cameras. It's part of me. I'll always be a storyteller.
So why retire? Why is now the moment to bid farewell to the paper?
It's been a great platform for me. I started in 72 when we were shooting black and white and color film, and stayed on that visual edge. I came from the west coast of Florida, Sarasota, St. Pete area, and where I went to school, and got a job here and in Orlando. And my first thought was I wanted my photos to connect to our community. That's my goal every day, is to capture something that tells a story. Whether it's a sad story or a happy story, I want to show that emotion, that human element.
Do you remember the very first photo the paper ever printed?
I remember the very first photo that I shot for the St. Pete Times, mm-hmm. When I was going to college. But I was trying to think about that. It's funny that you mentioned that, because I was trying to think of that because I thought that might be a question that you ask. I can't remember that exact moment. And it's interesting. I've been thinking about this. I'm so anal about details, and I'm a little upset at myself that I didn't remember that. But I also wanted to know how many pictures I've taken. I think that would have been a good little piece of intel.
And what's the answer?
Boy, I just thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands. But it just takes that one moment to tell the story. You can shoot a lot, but it's just capturing that one moment that connects with that reader, that viewer. That's what you want to do. I mean, that's what I want to do. And it's been such a great, rewarding career for me. But, you know, you said that I'm hanging my cameras up. But, you know, that's
just for the Sentinel.
Just for the Sentinel. I'd like to, one of my things that I want to do is there's a couple nonprofits that helped me earlier in my career that gave me some access. And I'd like to, in kind, tell their story. They're part of our community. And, our photos now reach much further than that, which I think is kind of cool. The reach, that's the other thing I'm so excited about, seeing photography has really, with Instagram, with social media, there's some really good photographers out there, but I really think it's a neat way to connect to people. Mm-hmm. It really is.
So do you have a lot of photos hanging up in your house? Like, is the a physical print still important to you?
Yeah, I don't have a lot. I have a couple in my den, but there are some important photos that I think that I've shot that I feel very proud of, that I've captured, that I got the access to, and I made it work. It was a difficult assignment, but I made the picture work. Mm-hmm. And those are the things that I might hang up as a physical print. That's a good question, because everything's digital now. Everybody looks at their photos on their phone or their iPad or computer, but you see that print hanging on a wall, it's got to mean a lot to me. Mm-hmm. But I don't have them all over the house, just a few things. One of the photos, there was a shuttle launch coming up, and I went to someone over at NASA, Bill Johnson. He was kind of a PIO lead, mm-hmm. photo lead, and I came up with an idea. And he said, I don't think anybody's asked to do that. Let me ask. And they gave me access to putting a camera on the launch pad and got a pretty cool picture out of it. But mm-hmm. I had some challenges to make it work. And that's the part that I love, is the challenge to come up with something different that moves the needle. That, to me, is the most fun part of what I do. And by investing that time, the reward goes to the viewer, to the reader. And that's what I try to do every day. And then the paper embraces that and said, oh, wow, we got something exclusive. So, you know, I believe I've gotten some really good access because I've earned that trust. And I think I want to be that trustworthy journalist.
So talking about the shuttle program, obviously that holds a pretty dear place in your heart as far as looking back on your career with the Sentinel. What are some other shots you took from that program that really stick with you?
Photographing the very first launch was, to me, just, in my career, was epic. We didn't know, you know, I had the very fortunate opportunity to photograph the Apollo program when I was still going to school. Got to come over and do Apollo 15.
Wow.
So going from the Apollo program and then going to the shuttle program, which no one knew how loud it was going to be because I built some sound sensors to do some remote photography. So there was a lot of unknowns. So I was very successful in those launches. I kept it real simple, and it worked. And I just kept on building on that. And mm-hmm. I wanted to tell their story on how you've got this man and a machine out there in this beautiful Merritt Island Wildlife Refuge. How does this man and machine, you know, coexist with nature?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, back in the 80s, that was a big deal about environment and what's going to do with, you know, the sound and all sorts of sound suppression systems they put out there. And so I wanted to do something different. And that's how I started out, thinking about the environment, how they coexist, but still documenting. That's the thing. We're there as a photojournalist to tell a story in our pictures, but we also want to inform them. We want to show things that's compelling. And there was one launch that came up, Matthew, that my mom had just passed away before this launch. It was like in November she passed away, and the launch is in December.
Which year was this?
1998. And NASA was just getting ready to put the first piece of the U.S. space station up on Endeavour, and I think it was STS-88. And it was supposed to be in the very early morning hours, and a storm came through. And it's scrubbed. So NASA escorts us out, puts us in a van, and we got reservice our remote cameras. And by doing that, rainstorm would go by, and the sun came out, and a full rainbow came out. It was unusual. It was very vibrant. And sometimes when you photograph a rainbow, it doesn't transcend that same vibrance. But this was extra vibrant. And it stretched across low, not high, out to the ocean. And I saw it, and I had my camera, like I've got right here with me, that has a wide-angle lens in it. And I jumped out of the van, got on the roof, and shot this picture. It was just gorgeous because it met right there at the launch pad with the rocket being exposed. The launch was rescheduled for the next day, but they still ran that. Well, NASA grabbed it, sent it to the crew in space, and Commander Cabana's daughter, or someone in the family, the next day they woke up, it was somewhere over the rainbow.
Wow.
And that photo is very, very, very dear to my heart because I was very uncomfortable about covering the launch. And I think because my mom passed away, and I really feel that she was looking down at me and giving me something that no one else got. And no one else had that picture. And she supported me so much. I haven't shared this story, but we had a small home over in St. Petersburg, and I embraced photography when I was a kid, mm-hmm. and I wanted to have a darkroom. There were many times in this small home that I'd be developing film, and she'd be knocking on the door of the bathroom and say, hey, and I said, no, you can't come in. She'd always support me in photography. I think that that's what that was all about, is that she was looking down and said, hey, I'm going to give you a gift. I'm okay. I'm in a good place.
So this was a one bathroom home?
Yes.
And you were using it as your dark room?
Yeah.
How did the photography bug bite you? Like, what got you started?
I don't know. I remember my mom shooting pictures with her brownie,
mm-hmm.
and she liked shooting pictures, and that's how I got started, is that she gave me a camera, and I always thought I saw some things differently. I was out with my buddies one day, and we were out fishing. I love fishing, and I saw something, and I said, hey, did you see that? What are you talking about, Red? So I always thought I looked at things differently. I don't know why, but I look at things differently. Maybe that's just my perspective. But I think you can learn photography, but I think sometimes to take it to another level, you have a gift of it.
It's the eye.
It is. I know that sounds kind of corny, but I think it is the eye. But let me just tell you, I can have the creativity, but if I don't have the trust or if I don't have the access, I can't get those different photos. So there's some that I try to look for something different that everybody has access to, and that feels good when you do that. But you want to connect. You want your photos to say, wow, that's what you want to do, and you want to tell that story.
What was working through Pulse like for you? What was it like taking photographs of that? I mean, you talked earlier in our conversation about really wanting to tell the story of a community, and this, unfortunately, has become something that Orlando is known for. So walk me through, from the photographer's lens, what did that look like to you?
Well, on that day, I wasn't there when it happened, or soon after, when a lot of people were during the early morning hours. I was not there. I entered that story to document it later that morning when daylight came up, and it was still pretty hectic going on. I wasn't on the ground at first. They sent me up into a helicopter to photograph, because it was pretty sealed off in that. And it was just to show what we could see and from that aerial perspective. And I love doing aerial photography. It's an interesting perspective. So I'm flying in a helicopter, and I come up in the scene just to show kind of a general what it looks like, just everything, you know, so they could have some photos just showing it from that perspective. With the crowd of people, you know, police, fire, everybody. And then I came a little closer and put on a little telephoto lens to get a little closer so I could see the actual Pulse nightclub. And I made a couple orbits, and it was a lot of people around, you know, and I could see different things that I could see a hole in a wall and where they blew it out, just kind of a general view. And then I got even tighter with my lens, and I actually saw a body laying in the porch area or in the bar area, and it was outside. And I didn't expect that, because, you know, when you think about, you got to get the information of what happened, is that everything happened inside. I didn't expect that. It took me back. It actually, I was kind of rocked by it. Yeah. I mean, I've covered, in 1985, I covered the Mexican earthquake, and I saw a lot of people that had passed away, and I was up at 9/11 covering that and saw quite a few bodies being pulled from there. So it's not something I haven't seen before, and I've seen accidents and that, but it rocked me. And usually as a journalist, you can't let something rock you. You have to be that down that middle, noncommittal either side. You have to be that, you got to be down the center line. You can't show any, you can't feel, you can't show any emotion, but you got to document it.
And that's tough.
I think what happened to me that day, that morning, was it rocked me. This happened in our community, my community, my hometown. And but once I got into gear, after I saw that body laying there, and I documented it. We actually did publish it. I got an angle that I could still show that. And that's the thing about, you have to show that. No disrespect to the person or anything like that, but you have to show that scene, because that's going to telegraph to a lot of people that, hey, this happened. it's part of our history, but we have to show those images. You see war images. Those photos make a difference.
And then documenting the aftermath of it and you know, talking about building relationships with people and getting access. I'm wondering, Red Huber, from your point of view, how do you approach a tragedy on the scale of Pulse? So many lives lost, so many, you know, people affected by this. How do you go about taking those photographs? Because these are people in their rawest, most, vulnerable moments.
Well, you try to be that fly on the wall, not in their face. But we're all, as journalists, we're all human first. Then we're journalists, or in any line of work. I think you have to have that compassion to be respectful. But you have to get that moment. You have to get the shot. Mm. You know, you really do, to tell that story correctly.
We are in the middle of hurricane season right now, right? September is the peak of hurricane season, and you have taken photographs of many hurricanes. Think
yes,
back to 2004, that year we got walloped by four hurricanes in a row. What was that like for you?
I was a busy guy. All of us were busy. But my daughter, we had just taken, my wife and I had just taken our daughter up to Clemson. She was a freshman. And I was actually supposed to photograph Charlie, but I didn't want to miss taking her to college. And so my wife and I and daughter went up there and took her up to school. And I actually had to photograph Charlie, some of the aftermath, Charlie, when we turned right around and a couple of days later and came back. But then it was like, oh, I've covered Hugo, I can go on and on how many hurricanes have come, but I'd never seen four like that, just bang, 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 bang. You know, it was just incredible. And I covered a lot of the East Coast because I thought it was coming, a lot of stuff was coming on the East Coast. And we had a set of photographers and people out everywhere, but it turned out very well for me in the sense where I happened to be.
Yeah.
And there's a few photos to me that I thought, I really enjoy the adrenaline of covering a hurricane. It's just, you got to respect it, but you got to be safe. And there's some tricks out there about the way the wind changes directions and what side of a building you should be on and what type of building to be on or not be on. But, oh my gosh, it's really something.
Coming up, Red Huber reflects on changes in the media in the last 45 years and what hasn't changed.
As a photojournalist, people want me there or they don't. There's no in between. I'm okay with that.
Our conversation with Red Huber continues when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're going to continue the conversation with Orlando Sentinel visual journalist Red Huber. He's been with the Sentinel for almost 46 years and now he's retiring. This is his last week there. When Huber joined the Sentinel, the photography department was still shooting in film and mostly black and white. When the Sentinel added video to its online platform, Red enthusiastically embraced the medium. One of his most popular videos was taken using a GoPro camera strapped to the back of an eagle. When you came onto the Sentinel, the photography department must have been very different, right? I imagine just the number of photographers you had, the approach to photography, the pride of place that photos would have in a newspaper.
Yes. When I came, actually, I was hired because I got a lot of experience using color film at the St. Petersburg Times, and it's the Tampa Bay Times now. But
so when you started at the Sentinel, had they started printing photos in color?
They did a little bit of color, but they wanted to increase that. They wanted to know people, and it's a different, you know, black and white and color is a different way that, you know, colors can distract. Mm-hmm. In a moment, so you have to be, you know, there's a whole bunch of different, but it was coming on to print color, and the newspaper back then was really aggressive on being on the edge, and I felt so good at being part of that. And the staff we had a company car that had, you know, Sentinel Star. We were called, you know, Sentinel Star back then. Mm-hmm. And then we had a morning paper or an afternoon paper called the Evening Star. And it really cranked back then in that respect. To me, it was very exciting because I'm just getting into the business professionally. And I was a new kid on the block. I was number 17. We're 17 photographers. at that time. And then it grew to 26. And
wow.
Yeah, 26 photographers we had on staff at one time.
And how many do you have now?
Well, we have video journalists, and I think there's a total, I'm saying maybe 6 or 7 now, and I'm included in that. You know, things have changed of the newspaper business and just media entirely. Media has changed, but what hasn't changed is storytelling. You still have to tell that story. You still have to, you know, as a photojournalist or as a journalist, you know, we want to hold people accountable, government. We want to police, fire, just people. You know, we're that watchdog. Watchdog journalism is so important.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes the photo can really punch that story up.
It can. And that's the other thing, too, is that photos sometimes bring someone into a story. You shoot a – you take a heck of a photograph that says a lot. That'll bring someone – and I got to read the story. That's a heck of a picture.
Mm.
So I think it's very important that we always embrace good storytelling, whether it be video. When we when the newspaper back in the day started to go multimedia, digital, CFN 13 was a new 24-hour local news thing that was hatched on our property. We had
News 13.
News 13. It was so exciting, so cool. I embraced it back then, video. Great medium video. Found that in your business, sound is so important. It is in video. But, you know, I got chills right now to talk about how video or how stills can move something to another direction in the sense of positive direction.
Do you think photographers get enough credit for the work they do? The political situation in the United States right now, there's some fantastic photographs of, yeah, of this administration and, of course, previous administrations.
Right.
Sometimes though, you'll see a photo that's printed in various places like Vanity Fair will pick it up or another
right.
magazine.
Correct.
And you're like, I got to find out who took that photo because it just tells a story all of its own.
You see, now, that's the thing I like that I just heard from you, that you want to find out who did that work. That means a lot to the photographer or to the visual journalist now that we're called. You want to do something that people are curious about. Me as a photojournalist, I'm curious all the time. That I think that's what makes me different in that respect, that with a combination of my eye and being curious. And, you know, I have to tell you, I learn all the time. And if anybody, any journalist, photojournalist say I've done it all, I don't believe that. Because I'm still learning, and I think that's how I stay on that visual edge.
Some of the photos of yours that really stick with me are the wildlife photos. Like I'm thinking of the story you told about the family of owls living at the Greenwood Cemetery.
Yeah.
And then the video, I think you stuck a GoPro camera on the back of an eel.
I'm very proud of that.
I mean, that's kind of a thread through your career, right? Those wildlife photos. I think it sort of goes back to the fact that you've always been into fishing and the environment.
Right.
How do you get some of those shots?
I'm going back to another thing, trust, access. It's knowing some people with the Avion Reconditioning Center in Apopka, Scott and Carol McCorkle, are good friends of mine. But in conversation, I always ask the question, hey, do you think we could do this? And they said, well, I don't know. And actually, this is like 4 years ago I did that video.
Right, yeah.
And it went kind of nuts across the platforms. And I was very proud of that. But I could tell that story in a different way. And that's what I'm getting at. I always want to try to do something different. It's my challenge. But I'll back her up a little bit. One time I was looking on the internet, and I saw a thread about two men that started something. Do you know what a golden eagle is? Have you ever heard of a golden eagle? It's larger than a bald eagle.
I've heard of it. I don't think I've seen one.
They're very big, very big birds. And this golden eagle, just picture this. You're in the Swiss Alps, and you've got cameras on the back of a golden eagle flying through the Swiss Alps.
Mm-hmm.
That was magnificent. But I had thought about putting a camera on an eagle a long time ago, but cameras weren't that small. Mm-hmm. So I took advantage of the GoPro. But I knew that that could be a possibility. But in talking to Scott McCorkle, who is a master falconer, said, you know, we have this eagle, young eagle, that fell out of a tree in Gainesville, and Fish and Wildlife gave it to us to rehab. It's really young. It's got to learn how to hunt fish. We think it can fly. And so they bought into it, and the paper bought into it. That's another thing, too, is that give me that time. I could have been a hero or a zero. But it worked out good to tell that story differently. And they were all in, like I was. And I think that that key, again, is having them on board. I could tell their story. And I've always admired the commitment that these people have from Audubon, from Avion Reconditioning Center. I can go on and all of these men and women that take care of these owls, these eagles, these hawks, and nurse them back to health and release them. And I thought this was a different way to tell that story. And it was a lot of work, a lot of hours, but that's what we do.
And it paid off. You just won from the Society of Professional Journalists the Photojournalist of the Year Award. What does that mean to you?
A lot. When your photos move the needle for your peers that think, wow, 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 I've done my job well. And, you know, I have to tell you, that is huge. But something else that I want to tell you is that moves me a lot more than that is before when I would get a letter in the mail about a photo. Now, as a photojournalist, people want me there or they don't. There's no in between. I'm okay with that if people don't want me at that location to photograph that person being arrested or, whatever it is. Or I've been at a fire, I've been at a shooting or whatever, and people are yelling at you. You shouldn't do, don't shoot my picture or whatever. But either they want you there or they don't. And I'm okay with that. And I've gotten letters that aren't very kind, and I've got letters that are very kind. But when I get a letter or now an email or now a text or whatever saying, wow, man, that image means a lot to me. And I have to tell you something. Just recently, there's two assignments that this Orlando Sentinel that I got to photograph a woman that was being self-deported to Mexico. And that was a cluster of journalists, a visual journalist, and we're looking to get the best photo and the best video. And I felt that my photo connected. It was at a peak moment that was unanticipated. Sometimes you can anticipate a moment. This one came out of the blue, but I was there at the right time, right place, and captured it. The widow of Matthew Baxter, the officer that was shot and killed a year ago in Kissimmee. His widow, Sadia Baxter, reached out to me. She was touched by some photos during the funeral, and she reached out to me, and she said, in working with some people that she has with her, she reached out to me through these people and said, hey, I'd like you to be somewhere. And it was the day before the anniversary of the shooting when her husband's gravestone and bench, they were being installed, but the next day she was going to go out and see it with her kids, and she wanted me to be there. That meant a lot to me, that she trusted me, that she knew that I would tell that story correctly. The photos were exclusive, but what meant more to me is that she trusted me to be there to tell that story.
Red Huber, the Sentinel staff, I'm sure, whether the photographers there or the journalists, they're going to miss you tremendously, and also, the community is going to miss seeing your photos, whether it's in the paper or online on the Sentinel website. You're sticking around, though, right? You're still going to be plying your craft as a photographer in some form or another.
Yeah, maybe in between some fishing, some sailing, some paddleboarding. But, yeah, I'd like to still tell some stories. I'm healthy. I feel You know, it's really funny. I feel really I'm excited about what's ahead. I don't know what's ahead. I want to tell some cool stories. I want to do the heart of photojournalism, whether it be video or stills or it's a calling, it seems like, almost, that I feel really I've got some more storytelling to do, but I want to do it kind of on my terms, in the sense that I want to tell some stories that I can really relate to, and I want to give back to the community too. I think that would be fun. I think that they've given me so much. I want to give back even more to the community, if it's possible.
What are you going to miss about the Sentinel?
The people. Actually, the institution. I do have a little bit of institutional memory.
Sure.
But it's what we've done as a newspaper, as a media group. We've done a lot. We broke a lot of ground. We did stuff no one did before. It's the people that I work with, those reporters, the editors. You'd throw an idea and they kind of, and then I'll say, that might work, you know.
Do you see some young photographers kind of picking up the baton? Do you see like a young Red Huber out there?
Oh, I don't know about going down that alley, but there's some really good talent there. Oh my gosh, I love it. And one young journalist who is he's a photojournalist, but he can write too. He's very talented. And Patrick asked me soon after he came here. He asked me, he says, hey, can I take you to lunch? I'd love to bend your ear about things. And he wanted to soak a little maybe experience up. I don't know. But I'm willing to give it. And I love that. I love that curiosity that trying to, because I soaked up a lot of, I was very fortunate to learn from a lot of great photographers, great videographers. And I learned from people not even within the paper. I learned from people that worked for the networks as video journalists, worked with National Geographic, these people that worked with other newspapers across the country, LA Times. I can go on and on. There's so many talented people out there. But, yeah, I do like the enthusiasm some of these young photojournalists, or we call them visual journalists now because we do video, we do stills, everything. But, it's interesting. I was a sponge. Sometimes you don't have people that want to ask questions. They feel that maybe they want to show you that maybe they don't have a lot of experience. Pride, I don't know. But I'm seeing a generation now of my daughter's age, who is 32 and younger. And this is millennia, and I don't know, is it Generation X? I don't know. What's the next?
I think we might be beyond that now.
Yeah, I don't know where we're at, but what generation? But there's a cool vibe I'm getting from these. I have these, I call them kids, but, you know, they're in their 20s, or 30s compared to me they are. But, man, they got what it takes. They really do. And I like that they will bend your ear. They say, hey, I'm learning. They don't think just coming out of college they know it all.
Red Huber, so fun talking to you, and thank you so much for joining us.
Matthew, it's an honor for you to reach out to me. I feel very fortunate that you wanted to talk to this journalist. It means a lot to me.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 News is supported by Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Shania Richburg. You can find us online at wmfe.org/intersection. Download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. And you can follow WMFE at WMFE Orlando. And thanks for listening.